Welcome to Paradigm Swap. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author and musician. We're going to talk more today about poverty versus wealth mindset. I've learned a lot this week and I'm still learning it. Most of it has not sunk in yet, so I don't give any of this information as some kind of an expert, but rather a student in the field, and I hope you take it as such. Much of what we discuss today is from a book that you may have heard of called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which if you're interested in this subject, I highly recommend you get that book, that you read it and study it carefully. There are some things in there that I struggle to fully side with just because of how money, I don't know, how materialist it sounds to me. And yet, I can't deny so much of what is said in the book about how poor and rich people think. And just the fact that I'm concerned about the materialist aspect of it tells me how deeply my poverty mindset is rooted. A really good point that is made, and I keep coming back to this every time I catch myself trying to say, oh, well, I don't want to worry about money anyway. I don't want to think about money. Is this fact, if you're somebody who says, well, I don't care about money or I don't think about money and so forth, and yet, are you spending 40 hours a week at a job or more hours a week than 40 at a job? If so, you're clearly concerned about money, but it's probably a fear-based concern. So let's talk about this a little bit. I think the biggest difference that I'm seeing is that poor people think about money as an end, and wealthy people think of money as a means. And that sounds a little backwards because you think I need money so I can pay my bills, so I can have my house, so I can whatever. But that's an ending point, the way I'm seeing it, starting to see it now. That's, you know, you throw your money into your food, which obviously you need to eat. You throw your money into your food, you eat your food, it's gone. Everything's gone. Whereas rich people or wealthy people think of money going into something to create more money. And it's not that they are so money-centered in their thoughts so much as they are money-conscious in their thoughts and also money-literate, which is another blow to the side for me. I've always said, oh, I can't even think about that. I don't want to. If you have that attitude, I can't think about that. I don't want to. You need to recognize that that is a lazy attitude. It's a lazy approach. Even saying, oh, I can't afford that, is lazy. Now, if it's something you really don't want and you're using I can't afford it as an excuse to not get it, well, fine. Whatever excuse you need to not get what you don't want, why are you seeking it in the first place anyway? You know, I tell my kids all the time, oh, we can't afford that. Not necessarily because we don't have sufficient money, but because, you know, I don't really want the thing and we have a pretty tight budget anyway, so it works out, you know, kind of idea. And that's fine, whatever. But it might be wiser from the things that I'm learning. It sounds like it might be wiser when, for example, a child asks for something and you really don't have the money for it, rather than saying, I can't afford it, saying something like, I don't have the money for that, but what could you do to get the money for that? Because that flips it on them, puts the responsibility on them and says, you can get that, but you got to find a way to get the money in order to get it. The lazy mind says, I can't afford it, because they don't want to work for it. And I don't mean that in the sense of they don't want to get their hands dirty and grit, you know, get it done a bunch of work so that they have the money. I'm not talking about that. The wealthy mindset is one of focusing on mental strength. A really strong, healthy mind can find a way to get what they need. That's just, that kind of goes without saying, but it needs to be said here because we're talking about wealth versus poverty. It's really easy to take on just enough martyr complex to say, well, I can't afford it. I don't have the money for that. What we ought to be saying is the empowering message of, I don't have the money for that right now. What can I do to get the money for that? Or what can I do to get that without needing money? And that kicks our brain into gear. Just saying, how can I afford it? Instead of just saying, I can't afford it, which is an excuse. Saying, how can I afford it? Kicks the mind into gear and you begin to think. Now the brain, the mind, is a muscle. Whatever you give it work to do gives it exercise that will strengthen it. It genuinely is like a muscle. And if you work at thinking in terms of how can I afford it, you will start thinking of ways to make money to get it or to find it without needing money. Okay. Along those lines, another point to be made is that the poverty mindset often puts, a poverty-minded person puts his mind to sleep around finances, whereas the wealthy has a habit of exercising their brain financially. Now, we're used to the idea of exercising our brain around creativity, or at least I am, around creativity maybe around parenthood, other things that I'm faced with on a day-to-day basis. But I've had a habit for most of my life to be very lazy-minded about money. And as a result, I've had to work extra hard to make up for my laziness. Isn't that the case with any kind of laziness? You're lazy about a particular thing, you pay the price in some way or another. And with money, the price is not ever having money to meet either your needs or your wants, whatever. So I thought that was a good point. Now, to the question of, well, if it's about exercising your mind, what do I need to be learning? And the first answer, and the most painful answer in my opinion, is, and which is the right answer, is financial literacy. If I'm not studying finances, if I'm not studying proper, appropriate investing, proper, appropriate accounting, things like that, I'm just allowing myself to be lazy and take the lazy way out. Now, it's so easy for me to want to say, that's okay, I don't even care anyway. That's easy to say, and yet next year, I'm going to be working my tail off just to make ends meet still, simply because I have been too lazy to develop that part of my brain. Now, another point that he makes along those lines in the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, is that not only should we get a financial education for ourselves, and I'm not talking about going to school. If that's how you want to do it, fine. Just don't expect them to teach you how to become wealthy, because the whole school system is about getting you a decent job, which is a way of getting somebody else wealthy and giving you a paycheck, which may or may not be there next year or next month, depending on if they keep you on or not. It's totally up to them. You're putting all your eggs in one basket, this job that is controlled by this person who doesn't have your welfare as their first priority. They can't. Their first priority has to be making their business work and taking care of their own family and so forth. If you are part of that, fine. If you're not, they'll just let you go. It's not a secure thing to be working at a job. It feels secure because somebody's handing you cash, but it's not secure. Anyway, the point that I wanted to make about that was that not only is a financial education important and one that you obtain on your own via books, videos, whatever you got to do, but also diversifying your education around the thing that you like to do. Now, the world pushes us, society pushes us to specialize. And it's not that there's something wrong with specializing, but what it does is it pigeonholes you into, if you're working a job and you specialize within that job, then the moment that specialization is either no longer needed or no longer available or you know, becomes saturated, that market becomes saturated, you suddenly have nothing to back you up. And that's not to say that, you know, I'm going to have a plan A, and if that doesn't work, I have a plan B. And then if that doesn't work, I'll have a plan C. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is having a wide variety of skills and experiences that allow you at any time to be able to move into another field. Let's say, for example, see, I'm into permaculture gardening. I'm also into music. I'm also into authoring books. Now, if I decide that I want to get a job at a newspaper, I can go and show them all my credentials, writing my books and all that stuff. And then if just the newspaper industry, something happens and it just kind of, you know, goes under, whatever, I can go to someone that's trying to hire a piano player for something, and I can do that. If I were to diversify even deeper within the music field, I may be able to help in music publishing, music editing, distributing, recording, all these kinds of things. It's all a possibility, and everything that I do, everything I experience, adds to that diverse education that can be used as a means to getting what I need. And in terms of this wealth thing, that doesn't always necessarily mean having something to put on a resume, but rather it gives you something wherewith to be able to create a business plan or an investment plan or something that is taking the power into your own hands. As a musician, I've been doing the market enough to be that I could sit down and come up with a business plan around a new approach to music or the music industry, whatever. I could, for example, start a recording studio, or maybe I could team up with a friend who has recording equipment and start a publishing industry or publishing company of some sort for new musicians or something like that. You see what I'm saying? Because I have this diverse field of education around. And this education is not one that I did in school. I did major in music in school, but that's not where most of my professional education came from. That may have been what gave me the confidence to try this professional music thing. And it does influence some of my composing in terms of, you know, how I structure chords and things like that. But for the most part, most of what I have learned has been from my own diving deep into the subject, listening to podcasts, reading books, studying marketing and whatever else around the topic. Same with writing, same with publishing, same with podcasting. All of these things that are experiences outside of one specialization equip me to be able to do more or to come up with more ideas later. And this question of investing, or this subject of investing, comes up over and over and over again. Let me clarify. We're not talking about investing in money markets. Though if you want to do that, that's great. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about things like investing in a small business that you start, investing in real estate, stuff where you are your boss. You go to make a purchase or a deal of some sort and then resell it at a profit, or maybe a service that you, in, you know, you could start a company. Say you love photography, but you don't know the first thing about a camera and you have no interest in holding a camera. Well, then you create a business where you hire photographers to go and take pictures of events. And I mean, there are so many photographers out there that want to do it, and they have incredible skill, but they don't yet have the knowledge of marketing and business to be able to do it for themselves. And they're like, I don't know what I'm doing. But you start making connections with, go to a, some wedding reception centers, gardens, and different places where, you know, even talking with wedding planners and so forth, and just get with them and start making connections and say, hey, I'm starting a photography business. Can you talk to me about what you've observed, what you would like to see more of in the photography side of things? I mean, just think, if you were to start a photography business, you could even have it specialize. Here's that specialty thing again, specialize in wedding photography. And, you know, you call it bridal shots or something. You get bridalshots.com, which is probably not available. I've never checked. But you start this business, and then you say, looking for photographers for, you know, rising business or something like that. And then suddenly you're hiring these people based on the information that you've got. You start a company, you have invested in a company that you have started yourself. You see where I'm going with that? Investing can be anything that is a money-creating thing. A really important point to be made is that poor people, they just pay their expenses. Middle-class people buy liabilities thinking they're assets, and wealthy people buy assets or pay for assets. Now, what's the difference between an asset and a liability? Well, from a wealthy standpoint, if you're wanting to be wealthy or thinking with a wealth mindset, assets are things that produce money. They're either engines that create money, or they're products that are that are sold for more money than they were bought for, things like that. A car, for example, you buy a car, a brand new car, that is not an asset. Not from a wealthy standpoint. A middle-class person buys a car thinking of it as an asset because they can declare it on their taxes as an asset. But from a wealth standpoint, that is not an asset at all. An asset, as we're going to be talking about for the rest of the time, an asset means something that has potential to produce money. And wealthy people buy assets. They focus their money on assets. Yeah, sure, they buy luxuries once they've got enough assets. And here's a difference too. Poor to middle class people, they use their money to buy, I want to say luxuries, but they buy stuff. And then they get into debt. Let me put it this way. They get into debt to buy liabilities. And liabilities meaning things that cost money. Okay? Or they continue to take money over time. If you buy a liability, let's just say a car, that car is never going to make money back for you. You may say, I'm saving money because it's, you know, it saves on gas and all this blah, blah, blah. I don't care how you word it. If you punch the numbers in the lifetime of that car, if it didn't give you more money than you put into it, it was a liability. Now, it's true that investments often fail. You try this business, you put in, I don't know, $10,000 to start this business, you make back $2,000, the whole thing goes under. Yeah, you lost. you lost. But it was an engine that was broken, not a liability. You see what I'm saying? It's an engine to create money. And wealthy people spend their money on assets and then spend the money they get from the assets on the luxuries, on the things that they want. Whereas middle class to lower people, lower income people, are more likely to get into debt for liabilities in order to look wealthy. The wealthy are not buying big fancy cars because they've got big money to spend on it. They buy fancy cars because they have assets that are handing them the money to buy those fun things. Does that make sense? If we were to think of our, think of it this way, okay? Let's say you love to watch movies, so you want a Netflix account. This is simplifying it to the level that most poor people should be able to understand. You could pay the $8 a month or whatever it is right now to have a Netflix account. Or you could do some research, do a small investment, come up with, I don't know, some kind of product, a digital sale. Let's just say you're an artist and you create pictures and you get that selling. Then you use that money that you get from selling to pay for your Netflix account. You see where I'm going with this? If you were to take every expense and put an asset over the top of it to say, this is how I pay for this thing. And I say expense. Obviously, if you've got a mortgage, that's going to take a little bit more work, a little more time. But most people with a little work, a little homework, a little playing around could make $8 a month. And if you say, this is my Netflix asset. Now, if it really works and you find yourself getting $80 a month, then maybe you'll want to say, well, maybe I should invest some of this money. It pays for Netflix, but maybe I should have some of it go back into a further asset. And that is what wealthy people do as well. In fact, as far as how much they save versus how much they invest, they tend to invest 80% and save 20%. The poor do the opposite because they're afraid of being out of money. And because they're afraid of being out of money, they save 80% of their profits, after everything is all said and done. They have a tendency to save 80% and then put 20% into some kind of investment to try to better their situation for the future. Wealthy people do it the other way around. If you focus on assets, if you focus on money-making machines, and you diversify them, you are much more likely to succeed. Let's say only 1 in 10 of your attempted assets actually bring something in. If that 1% or that 1 out of 10 or 10%, the one asset is enough to pay for the others long enough to find out whether they're going to work or not, then you can keep them going. If you find they aren't working, well, get rid of them and do a different asset. And keep trying to do that. Once you've got one that's just established, it's working, it's a passive income or some kind of, I want to say effortless business. I don't think there is such thing, but something where you are able to do very little work to be able to get a good turnover. Let's say you have a book that you publish and you order copies for yourself and then you ship them out to people. That is something that's a little work, but for, you may be making $10 per book because you're charging $15 and $4 of that is shipping or whatever, you spend an hour shipping out books and you'll find you have enough money at that point to even hire somebody to do that much and say, you get this percentage and I'll take this percentage, or whatever, you know. If we could attach assets to our expenses and then use the surplus to get more assets, then what we'll eventually find is that, you know, many will fail along the way and the rest will provide a nice living. That's the idea. That's the theory. But speaking of theory, money is a theory. It's not a thing of itself. The only reason that little green-gray piece of paper means anything or has any value outside of fire kindling or you know, a bookmark is because people decided it was so. Now, that's not a bad thing. I mean, that thing can be useful. But here's the difference. Poor people work for money. Wealthy people make money work for them. Think about that person who owns this photography company that they created. They don't even do photography. And then they hire somebody to manage it because it's doing so well. What are they doing in that company? They're basically just answering the occasional question from the manager and paying, you know, they've got an accountant to do the taxes they've hired, and they've got this, you know, all these people doing it, and they're just getting this passive income. That's what passive income is about. I've seen it myself on a very small level, and that is through my music. I'm able to create it. Yes, it takes work, it takes time, it takes talent. I create the music, I put it up, I get it out there, and then I have to do nothing in order for that money to come in. Now, I occasionally will, you know, do some marketing efforts of trying to get it better known, or, you know, share it on social media or different things to kind of boost it along. But that's very minor effort for what it brings in. And that's the idea of passive income, is that while you're sleeping, money is coming in. And while you're working, money is coming in. And when you're vacationing, money is coming in. You see where I'm going with that? That's the goal. Now, the other kind of money making, you've got money earning, which is you go punch in your hours or your salary, whatever, you know, how much money per year, how much money per hour, whatever, and you're handed a paycheck. That's earned income. The second that we've talked about is passive income. The third is portfolio income. Now, I don't understand that yet. I've still got to study that, so I'm not going to go into that detail, but there you go. And then there's four major kinds of money makers, as in people who make money. There's employed people. That's what most of us have experienced most of our lives. Self-employed is a person who employs themselves. This is the photographer that goes and takes pictures at weddings and then, you know, sends them the pictures. They get paid. They employ themselves. And then you've got a business owner, which is the one who owns that business, gets that income passively. And then finally, you've got the investor, somebody who simply buys into a thing and gets more money back. And if they do it really wisely, they can get a lot of money back. People in real estate apparently are known for making quite a bit. Somebody may buy a bank-owned property for $30,000 and sell it within a couple of weeks for $60,000. They just made $30,000 in 2 weeks. Now, if they turn that around and spend it on another property that is $30,000 and then can turn around and sell it for $80,000, you can see where this is going. But it sounds scammy. It sounds scammy. But the fact is, the more you get into how money is made, it just is scammy. But when it comes down to it also, and you look at all parties involved, a person who pays the $3 for the ice cream cone that they bought, big old burly ice cream cone at the ice cream shop, they paid $3 for that ice cream. It cost the store or the restaurant probably 35 cents to 50 cents at most for that ice cream cone. And then, of course, a lot of that, the rest of that money goes to employees and to pay the lights and the bills and so forth. And then a big chunk goes to the owner of the store who maybe only comes in once in a while for an ice cream cone. Or to you know, check with the accountant and see how they're doing with the taxes and so forth. You see where I'm going with that? The point that I wanted to make about that is that the people going in the store are not under the delusion that it costs the store $3 to get that ice cream cone. If they are, they are extremely naive. Everybody knows that the store didn't have to pay as much for that as you did. But the fact is, those individuals, they don't have the time or the interest in going about the work necessary to get that ice cream cone themselves. They could go to the ice cream, they could go to the warehouse and order large quantities of ice cream and then, you know, break it down to the amount, and it costs them only 30 cents to 50 cents for that ice cream cone then. But they've often got to do it in bulk, or they've got to do it making connections with the kind of connections the restaurant has made and so forth. Basically, when it comes down to it, a person is paying for a lot more than ice cream. They're paying for the opportunity to have an ice cream shop right there. They're paying for the person who owns the ice cream shop, because without them, the ice cream shop couldn't be there. So when you're tempted to feel squeamish about selling, just recognize people don't expect to pay what it cost you for it. And as to how does one, as a new growing business, find the connections to be able to purchase at wholesale prices or even less sometimes. And that is part of this education that we're talking about. If you don't know that, dig in and find out. Find out. If you don't know where to start, start with a Google search. Read what you need to, or read what you can, to find what it takes. I've gone through multiple videos, podcasts, and articles sometimes, just to find the right word to do the search that I want to do. There's times when I have something that I need to research, and I know what I need to research, but there's no way that I can figure out to type it in to a Google search and just get an answer spat out. It just doesn't work sometimes when you know there must be a term for such a thing, but you don't know what that thing is. So you have to just bumble your way through, and you read article after article and listen to or watch YouTube videos and listen to programs, and then somebody says this and such is called whatever. And you're like, okay, there's the word. And then you hurry in, and maybe you're not even sure. Maybe you're like, is that the word? And so you Google that word, and you find, boom, there's all this information about it. And then you're able to study it and find it. That's why research is so important, and why it's so possible today. You can research just about anything on the internet. In fact, I would submit that just about any kind of education that you need can be done by simply developing some research skills with the internet. If you get to the point where you're so good at it and you're so apt at what you're doing that you can find the exact bit of information that would cost to get but is worth that money, then I'd say you've done your homework enough for it to be worth it to pay that money to get the information. Because chances are, you know more than 95% of the population of those who know a lot about that subject. Once you're getting to the point where the only thing that you can do to get more information than what you already have is to pay for it, means that you are already so far ahead of the competition that you might as well just go ahead and pay for that, because that knowledge, be that through a class, be that through a, you know, paid article system, whatever. I don't know if that makes sense, but my point is that for 95% of us out there in the business ventures that we want to do, you don't have to pay to get the knowledge that you need. You just got to practice and learn and develop research skills. And along the lines of education and research, keep in mind also that information, or I should say education, becomes obsolete incredibly fast right now. So when you know, and be that education about your field, about a particular type of investment, about tools that are used for, you know, what you're trying to do and so forth, keep up on that education. Be constantly studying new stuff. Give yourself a, you know, maybe a schedule that once a week you spend an hour just studying the new material, or whatever amount of time, whatever works best for you. Keep studying that material, because being at the edge of what's possible and what's available will also give you a huge advantage. There are professionals who started in the 1940s who have been at the top of their game since the 1950s, simply because when the new tool comes out, they use it. Doesn't necessarily replace the old tool, but they add it on. And then the tool that's become obsolete, they dump it. And they just ride with the times. And when something changes, they change with it. That's the beauty of working for yourself, of being your own boss, or of being having your own company. You can change however you need to, whenever you need to. If you work for a boss and you're, you know, in this growing business, and you go to him and say, look, I know we're kind of the stars of the film camera, but I think we could do well by switching to digital. I can guarantee you, if you're doing well with film camera, you'll also do very well with digital. And chances are there will come a time where you have to either make the change or allow yourself to be mowed over. That won't always be the case, not in every field, but you will always have an advantage by keeping up with the tools and knowledge, especially knowledge about your industry and about the thing that you do. And because we are at a time of such flux, when change is happening so quickly, it doesn't take that long. If you have a very niche industry, we'll just say with one of your assets, a particular asset that you've gotten pretty good at working, it doesn't take that much work to become a leader in your industry. And the moment you become a leader in your industry, you also have the power to steer that industry, at least part of it, which means you can create new tools. You can be the one who's showing and coming up with new ideas. And that's an exciting idea. And as someone coming up with those ideas, you're getting your foot into a doorway to a mansion that you don't even know exists yet. And you find your way into that mansion, get your foot in that door and hold it open, and you will find that you are at the front of the line that makes that thing work. So, anyway. Okay, also in this book, in addition to financial literacy, which is an education thing, there's also discussion of financial genius, which is that inner part of you, that creative part of you that has power to create and has power to come up with ideas and so forth. He keeps talking about using your financial genius. And in order to help develop that financial genius, that little thing that can help you to know what investments, what to try, what things to buy assets in. These are things to develop and practice your God-given financial genius. He talks about how you need to find a reason that is greater than just the reality around you. Okay? The power of your human spirit is what that's about. Okay? And in order to kind of develop your reason for why you're doing what you're doing, or why you want to do what you want to do, you need to think about what you want and what you don't want. And if those reasons for why you want what you want and why you don't want what you don't want are strong enough, then the reality of the road ahead of you may be even stronger than your reason itself. So your reason may be, I want to have time for my children. I want to not have to be worrying about money at a time when I should be taking care of my parents and should be looking after my grandchildren, and or whatever it is. You may have that as your reason, but as you think about what you want and what you don't want, you know, I want to have my own business, for example. I don't want to work for somebody else that could just up and fire me at any time. I don't want to have to show up at work in order to walk home with a paycheck. I want to be able to have a vacation every year. Or I want to be able to contribute large amounts of money to a particular charity or cause that's important to you. All of those things, if they are strong enough, then they may carry you through, even when it looks like things won't work with your original reasons for wanting to do it. Does that make sense? Okay. Another one, make daily choices. Okay. The power of your choice is unlimited. And the more you see that, the more power you have. Recognize that opportunities are what you're looking for rather than simply money. Because opportunities can mean opportunities for assets, opportunities for connections that will push you into an even better situation tomorrow, and so forth. Okay, here's another one. Master a formula, okay, formula for making money or whatever, and then learn a new one. And learn to learn those kinds of things quickly, to get those lessons quickly. If failure comes quickly and the lesson comes quickly, then it will quickly feed into the next opportunity, the next attempt. Learn to fail fast. Learn to learn from your failure. And don't be afraid of failure. Be totally comfortable with it. It's not like you're going to like it. Of course not. But be comfortable with it. And be comfortable with failing over and over and over again. Because it's in taking risks that you're able to come ahead. Okay, another one, and this one is one of the most important, is the power of self-discipline. We often think of self-discipline as being something for putting money in savings. And yes, that does take self-discipline. But putting money in savings simply puts it somewhere where you can access it immediately at a given moment. Or maybe it's even there for the taking later in like a CD account, whatever. How much more self-discipline would it take to invest in an asset that's a little bit risky, won't have anything handed back to you immediately, but could potentially take really good care of you later, could really pay off later. In many ways, it takes more self-discipline to invest than it does to save. And so developing that kind of, that level of self-discipline where you're willing to put it at risk in order to make it work for you is a really powerful exercising of that muscle, of learning to develop that financial genius that you already have. Another one is pay yourself first. This is something that has kind of blown me away, that I don't fully get. But pay yourself first is not saying first take a chunk and put it in your savings for you for later. And it also doesn't necessarily mean a chunk for you to put aside for that thing that you want, that luxury, that car, that vacation, that fun thing. But rather, pay yourself first generally means, if I understand the wealth mindset, generally means invest that money in assets. And if it takes a little bit of time for you to get the money to be able to put into an asset, fine. Just put it in that asset and then let that asset begin to save up further and develop the discipline to be able to put that into an asset. It's really like having savings that may or may not still be there, but has potential to really take care of you well later. I know, it's gambling. But it's the kind of gambling that is smart, which is one of the reasons, too, you want to develop your financial literacy, because you don't want to go into an investment, you know, somebody just says, hey, give us your money and sell our products and we can help you make all this money. That's not really an investment. It's a risk, but it's not really an investment, because what you're doing is giving your money to somebody else's product. If you just love that product and really want it, well, then consider it a luxury and treat it accordingly. But if you're wanting to invest in an asset, develop that self-discipline by doing so. Okay, another way to practice that financial genius is what we've already talked about, using assets to buy luxuries. In fact, I would go so far as to say, if you're struggling with making ends meet and you just don't have fun stuff, let's just say you can't even afford Netflix, not talking about anybody specifically, nobody specifically. If you can't afford Netflix, come up with an asset with the intent of paying for Netflix with it. And tell yourself, if the asset doesn't make the money, I don't get Netflix. And if I really, really want Netflix, I'll put some other asset into making money for Netflix. And just think, if you use that, you know, and have this asset is intended to create money to get more assets, and you create this engine of asset building. That's what wealthy people do. That's what they do. They have their money in so many different assets, each of which are either making money or in the process of cleanup from failing, that, I mean, by the time they are getting their luxuries, often it's because their asset that paid for their asset that paid for their asset paid for that luxury. Why don't we think this way? Why don't we? Because we think we can't afford it, which again is lazy thinking. Okay, another part of this educational, self-educational process is learning, and by education I mean study as well as experimentation, to try things, is learning how to recognize a potential investment when it comes along. Now, a brand new person, fresh into, let's say you want to, invest in, you know, Legos, okay? A very favorite, popular toy. My kids love Legos. Let's just say I want to invest in Legos. If I go about finding places I can get Legos, either in quantity or in, you know, specialized sets and so forth, I can get really good and educate myself in where to go to get the best deals. And in so doing, I'm going to learn how to do that in just about any field. And every additional investment that you make, every additional asset that you seek out, every additional money-making scheme, if you will, that you try, you'll learn some things that will help you with the next effort. Wealthy people don't put all their eggs in one basket. They put them all over the place. And the cool thing about it, especially if you're not in this to make big bucks, but want to think like a wealthy person doing things that you love, is that you can invest in topics that you love. For myself, I love plants. I love trees. I love gardening. And I'd like to invest in that. I'd like to be the guy to turn to get trees, to get plants. If I play it right, I should be able to create a business plan, a financial plan, to be able to have, you know, just dozens, if not hundreds of trees available at any time for sale. And how long will it take for that business to pay itself off so I have made more money than I have put into it? I don't know. It depends on a lot of things. But if I start, not too small, but small enough that it's not going to devastate all my assets, but I put this into an asset, we'll just say a tree company, then what I'll find along the way is resources for getting all the trees and plants I could ever want. And think about this. If you're saving your money for something for, you know, let's just say for an entire year, you're saving up for a thing, then you spent that time, that work, that effort getting that thing. And all those hours that you spent at work that add up to the amount of money that is devoted into that thing, all that time, effort, and money is devoted to that thing that you wanted. What if you were to spend that much time, that much money on investing in that thing? In other words, you buy those things, perhaps in bulk, and then sell them at a profit, say a retail price, make enough money that you're able to get those things, and you have them on hand, you're able to get them at warehouse prices, and you're able to obtain it. I think you can obtain things faster that way. That's my understanding. So think of something that you want to spend your money on, something that excites you to spend your money on. Maybe you don't have the money for it at this moment, but the idea of having it excites you. Then I suggest that you find a way, using your financial genius, which you're trying to exercise and develop, to sell that thing. Perhaps even before you even have your own. You buy one to sell. You buy it on discount, maybe in a thrift kind of a situation, bank-owned, depending on what kind of thing it is that you have. Find a way to get it, sell it, use those profits to get another, sell them, and start a tiny industry around that thing. You see where I'm going? That's just one way to do it. That particular thing is not specifically out of the book, but I think that's one way that can be done. Figure out what you love to spend money on and become the person that people go to get that thing. I mean, why wouldn't you do that? You love that thing, right? You're a collector of that thing. Get that thing and sell that thing. Be the guy, the girl for that thing. If you're going to be spending money on it anyway, or saving up for it anyway, you can get a heck of a lot more of them that way. Heck of a lot more. Not to mention, if you make the effort and the business just bombs, chances are all this product that you have, assuming that you didn't take it on as a major loan and have to sell it back or whatever in order to get your money back, you'll have all this leftover product that, oh well, I guess I get all this anyway. I don't know. That's just my thoughts on some of those things. The point is to develop that financial genius, to find ways of seeing investments in everything. When you go to the store and you see stuff, you say, I could do this with that, invest in that, make money at it in this way. That's how wealthy people think, I think. And those who develop this mindset learn to make money work for them. They do work, and they work hard. But their work is much more focused than simply being handed a paycheck for putting in X number of hours or X number of years. To the poor person, something like benefits and I almost said Y2K, 401ks, retirement plans, and so forth, they're all carrots being dangled out. And maybe after this long 40-year walk, maybe you'll get that carrot. Maybe you will if you stick with it long enough. And perhaps there's a guarantee that you'll get some portion of it no matter what. But you're still dangling a carrot. Why not invest in carrot seed and grow your own carrots? I don't know. Maybe that's a funny way of thinking of it. But how is it that you could be the owner of carrots? If you are the owner of carrots, you can dangle them in front of others. Hire them to do a lot of the work that needs to be done. My understanding is that's the way that wealthy people think. The unfortunate thing is that this is also the reason why wealthy people are often not willing to hand over $1 million to their buddies who say, hey, if you just give me $1 million, I can solve all my own problems. The problem is that money's not the problem. It's the mindset. If you were to hand a person with a poverty mindset $1 million, they would either just save or spend $1 million. And would be no better off in the long run for it. Now, those who are, you know, wise poverty mindset people may be able to live off the interest comfortably and may get good at dealing with the weird tax issues that you have around that, whatever. And they may be able to survive with that, okay. But are they really better off? Are they really better off? Not so sure of that. Being really smart in poverty mindset means getting really thrifty, really good at making $2 go a long way. And that's a skill that you ought to develop as well. But why not also develop a healthy, wealthy mindset? If you've got both and you can save money on the things you don't want to spend money on anyway, but for whatever reason have to, if you can find all these little ways to cut off expenses on the periphery of the things that you don't want and invest more money into the things you do want, I mean, how cool is that? It's kind of like the author, I believe it was the author of Eat, Pray, Love, who said, we need to do a lot more of the things that we love doing and a lot less of the things that we hate doing. Why do we spend so much money on things that we don't want to spend money on anyway? It's simply because we are stuck in our poverty mindset. And we may be really smart at it, but why not use that financial wisdom, smarts, if you will, to use a wealthy mindset to make money work for us. Make your money pay for that expense so that you can spend your money on things that you actually want to have, want to do, want to experience. Anyway, that's a good part of what I've been getting out of this study of wealth versus poverty mindset. I'm being very careful not to jump into anything too quickly, which is probably my poverty mindset saying, don't take too many risks. But I do have some things I'm going to change based on what I'm learning. And I'm hoping that I can work this financial genius muscle. And also, and in that, as I do so, become more financially literate, study finances, as blah as that sounds to me. If I get good at it, I will have a lot more to work with. I'll have a much more refined and strengthened financial genius from which to draw all these ideas and things that are possibilities. So, that will create possibilities for me and for my family and so forth. Anyway, if you would like to support the podcast, you can do so by becoming an ongoing monthly contributor at patreon.com/Chaz Hathaway. And if you do contribute $15 a month, that will also give you access to all of my digital works, my books, my music. And with that, thank you, all of you, so much for listening.